Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and today I'm proud to bring you the Pep Talk with John Carl Pepe. But first, a legend of Hercules. This is Demon Realm by Medea Press, issue number 0. The island of Santorini, which some claim is a remnant of Atlantis, is a nexus through which one can access other dimensions. The Olympians of Greek mythology once vanquished the demonic Prometheans on Santorini and expelled them from our world. They remained there to guard the gates, and their civilization flourished. 5,000 years or so ago, devotees of the demons performed a foul blood ritual that allowed the Prometheans to return. The Olympians were able to defeat them once again, but at great cost. The 12 sacrificed himself to save our world. Hercules, who wished to fight beside them, was instead charged with guarding the gates, keeping the flame of Olympus burning and perpetuating the Olympian bloodline. From his mighty loins would string generations of heroic individuals, all of them with powers greater than Hercules, who would assume their responsibilities. Alas, these tales were never published and remain untold. And that is the sad truth. And now, without further ado, John Carl Pepe.
How's it going, Hercules?
It's going great. How's it going with you?
It's going good. You know, funny thing happened on the way to the podcast, which maybe I might elaborate on a little bit. But, yeah, I was cutting it down to the wire tonight. But, man, I am happy to be here. It is the first Sunday of the month. Love the Legends of Hercules intros. And, boy, if only someone like Bob Layton would do a comic book of those untold Legends of Hercules that never officially got published. That would be something I would love to see down the road. Well, you know, maybe if you ever talk to Bob again, you can kind of put that under his nose, because I think that would be a fantastic thing for him to tackle. But here we are, folks. It is the first Sunday of the month. It is August 6th, 2023, and this is the Pep Talk. And I just want to kick things off. I want to kick it off on a good note. So we have a couple birthdays coming up. Friend of the show, Marty Appel, his birthday is tomorrow, August 7th. Had a great conversation with Marty back at the end of June when we did our special edition of the Pep Talk. And my guest tonight was also involved in that, and we'll get to that in a second. But most importantly, and not to slight Marty in the least bit, because Marty is a class act, no doubt, but it is also my sister Jane's birthday tomorrow, Monday, August 7th as well. So, Jane, I will be giving you a call tomorrow. I love you. I know I've talked about how much of an influence on me you were on the show before. None of that has changed in the last year since your last birthday. So happy birthday. I look forward to talking to you tomorrow. Now, unfortunately, since we last met at the Pep Talk, we did have two significant losses to pop culture. First and foremost, the beloved Paul Rubens, the man who was Pee-wee Herman and the Penguin's father twice, in the Batman world. He silently battled cancer for the last 6 years, and unfortunately we lost him at age 70. And that was a big blow to a lot of people personally, and of course to the landscape. And of course, the other one was Sinead O'Connor at 56, I believe. And boy, what a talented, complicated woman who I feel never quite found the peace that she deserved in life, but I hope she has the peace that she deserves now. And Sinead O'Connor and her controversy in the early 90s actually does figure into tonight's guest. So as I mentioned before, tonight's guest, he batted cleanup for me for when Marty was on, and he did a great job coming in, and we talked about the New York Yankees and his love for the Yankees, and we shared some great anecdotes and stories. This is a guy that I have known for, over 30 years, I think, almost at this point, and is just such a wonderful human being. Such an inspiration in a lot of ways, which we'll kind of get into in a little bit, and somebody who has just been able to have his finger on the pulse of pop culture throughout almost his entire life. And I know a lot of that comes from growing up in and around New York City, but really a lot of it is just who he is and how he moves and how he operates and how he treats other people. So, folks, I am very happy to welcome our returning guest tonight, pop culture guru, real-life Zelig, and a man who also has a birthday coming up on August 9th. So this is his special birthday show celebration of the Pep Talk. Folks, give a warm round of applause and a hearty happy birthday to my good friend, Matthew Lewis Demick.
Hi, John. I'm happy to be part of the Pep Talk tonight. Thanks for having me back on. And, yep, my birthday's coming up, another year in the books. Time flies when you're having fun. And,
yes,
you know, another year of experiences behind me. You know, I had a great time on the show last time. I appreciate you having me on, and I'm very happy to be back. The other night, somebody stopped me in the halls at Madison Square Garden and said, hey, weren't you that guest from the Pep Talk with Marty Apple a couple of weeks ago? And, you know, I'm already starting to get, you know, noticed and recognized from my exposure through the Pep Talk. So I appreciate it, and I'm happy to be on tonight. And, yeah, like I said, time flies when you're having fun.
Yes, it does. We call that recognition the Peppy bump. So expect yes. More. You know, a lot of people that I have encountered, you know, they've gone on to pretty good things. So some of it is through the Pep Talk, some of it's before then. But yeah, that's awesome. That's funny. So Matt, last time we talked about you know, the Yankees and your love for the team and your philosophy on being at the right place at the right time. And I kind of want to get into that a little bit, because not only did you spend the last seven of the last nine nights at Madison Square Garden, Madison Square Garden is almost your home base for a lot of experiences that you've had. And I want to get into that. I also want to get into the last week's worth of shows. We're going to talk about the band that you saw a little bit. But before we get into that, I kind of want to talk about your career path and how you have been able to have jobs that do kind of run alongside and within the entertainment industry, which is another way that helps you sort of, you know, be in the right place at the right time. So I want to talk a little bit just about your career path, you know, from, you know, basically what you were studying in college and then where you kind of wound up, because I think it's really interesting and you've got a lot of really fascinating, interesting, and intriguing jobs.
Well, you know, it all goes back to, you know, I have to give my dad a lot of credit.
Mm-hmm.
Watching him, you know, through his careers and, you know, his career journey and his career path, and seeing how he would always find a way to, you know, be in the business or be in the industry where he'd be rubbing elbows with people like Andy Warhol or Truman
mm-hmm.
Capote. Or he would be, you know, in the right place at the right time at the Diana Ross concert in Central Park during the big rainstorm. And, you know, somehow my dad would always find his way onto the scene, whether he was out in Las Vegas, he was staying at the Hilton back in 1980 when there was a big, big fire out at the Hilton.
Mm-hmm.
And he would always, you know, find himself in, you know, these certain situations, you know, just kind of by being in New York City. And,
yeah.
You know, I always watched him, and I always watched how he would kind of, you know, gravitate towards certain things. And, you know, you learn, you know, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And so, you know, really my journey began at Madison Square Garden with my mom. And she and I used to take the bus into the Felt Forum to see Bugs Bunny. And Bugs Bunny with Batman, the Joker, you know.
I remember
those. Put on,
I went
yeah,
through,
every year.
I went through a few of those.
Oh, we might have been sitting in the same audience.
We might have been in the same one, there's no doubt.
Oh,
I remember I got
sure,
the coloring book.
Sure. I still have the coloring book, absolutely.
Of course you do.
And actually, today at Madison Square Garden, if you go all the way up to the rafters by the Sky Bridge, They have a really nice montage of old programs, old mixed programs, old boxing, wrestling programs, and they do have some of those Bugs Bunny meets the Super Friends coloring books.
Cool.
So my mom used to bring me on the bus, and, you know, once a year we'd come in, we'd go to the Felt Forum. I had no idea the incredible lineage and history of concerts that had taken place at the Felt Forum up until that time. And so from the Felt Forum, we graduated to the circus at Madison Square Garden proper. Ice Capades, you know, once a year, usually we would go and we would see an event at the Garden. And when I was old enough, I started getting into WWF wrestling in the 80s. And I dragged my mom out to steel cage matches. And, you know, I'd go with my dad. And my dad had a knack, again, for being at the right place at the right time. And we'd always kind of find our way over by the stage door where the wrestlers would come in and come out. And boy, was that a learning experience. Because, you know, you see these guys who, you know, on TV, you see them, they're larger than life. They're real life superheroes. But I got a chance to see them get out of a cab on 8th Avenue and be right up close and personal, you know, with them in the setting that wasn't, you know, inside the ring. And then you'd see them inside the building, and they were, you know, a totally different performer. I'll tell you, you know, to be a 8-9-year-old kid and be standing next to Andre the Giant is like standing next to the real-life Hulk, you know. It really is, you know. So I fell in love with the Garden through wrestling, and that, you know, was going to wrestling shows. And then I started going to, you know, I started getting into music a little bit more. And went to some really great shows in my teenage years, Guns N' Roses, Metallica. You know, I was into a little bit of a heavier vibe back then, and really saw some good concerts. And always wanted to experience something, always wanted to enjoy something. And you know, went on to college. Interesting that you brought up Sinead O'Connor. 1992, yep. Went with my buddy Sean to the Bob Dylan tribute concert, which had every name, Eric Clapton to George Harrison to Neil Young, all on the same stage paying tribute to Bob Dylan. Sinead O'Connor came out, and she had just ripped up a picture of the Pope on Saturday Night Live. Now,
very
we're talking
famously
1990-
on Saturday Night Live.
Oh, yep. For sure, 1991, 1992, and she came out on stage. And I'll tell you, over all the years, only time I've ever seen someone get booed off the stage at Madison Square Garden. She had to actually leave the stage. And Neil Young came out and saved the day.
as he wants to do.
Yep, and kind of picked the energy back up and got the room rocking again. But that, you know, really led me to my college career. And, you know, through college, I was a communications major. During my years at college, I had internships at NBC, at CNBC in Fort Lee, New Jersey, and on Politically Incorrect with Bill Maher when it was on Comedy Central. That opened a lot of doors for me to do production assistant work on Comedy Central and on some commercials, some locally filmed commercials. And then once I graduated from college, I had a little bit of experience under my belt. So I naturally gravitated towards something that would be in that light where my experience was. And where I was when I graduated was right on the cusp of everything turning from video to digital. So it was a little bit difficult navigating through those waters if you wanted to find a career in a practical sense where you wanted to be an editor or, you know, a cameraman, camera operator. But I had a lot of on-set experience and was able to get an opportunity at Industria Super Studios, which
I know it will.
One of the largest fashion and at the time was one of the largest fashion and production studios in the entire world. From there, I, you know, explored that industry for about 12 years. Worked, in a lot of different capacities in the studios. From working the night shift, you know, dragging sets upstairs and breaking down all the shoots and, you know, closing everything up and, you know, painting the stage when it was all done on the weekend to, you know, actually booking the studios and managing the studios and making decisions on the, on the business. I was very happy to have some great opportunities at Milk Studios, where we did 32 fashion shows a year. It's about 16 shows a season. And that afforded me, again, a lot of opportunity now to work live events.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, around the time I was in college, I started getting into, some different styles of music. Started getting into the Grateful Dead and improvisational music. My grandfather was a jazz guitar player, and he used to play guitar for us in the living room after dessert on holidays. And so I was always drawn to guitar music. My grandfather used to love watching him just get lost in what he was playing and to be in the zone. And so I was always kind of chasing that experience in a live music setting. And I found, the music of the Grateful Dead and then from there, the music of Phish, and was able to, start following those guys around while at the same time working in the studio setting.
Mm-hmm.
And, over time, again, businesses change and, I had put in about a decade at the studios. And then it was time to reinvent myself a little bit. But, I left the business, went to a different industry, but always wanted to kind of remain in the central part of town, always wanted to remain in the heart of what was going on. And so, very easy and natural for me to pick a job where my office was just a couple of blocks away from Madison Square Garden. Right? That's where all the action is. So, if you have a band that's playing five nights a week, close up at work, take a walk a couple of blocks, grab a slice of pizza, you're right there, and treat it like you're going out to a movie.
Exactly.
It was a lot easier in my younger days.
But
I formulated some good habits back then. I learned some good tricks, so I'm able to, keep the momentum going today. You always gotta have a comfortable pair of shoes. That's the first thing.
Now I just want to touch back on something. For those that don't know, Industria Super Studios, Milk Studios, these are places that, as Matt said, they do a lot of fashion shoots and events there. And basically it's designed so big publications, when magazines were far more frequently out there at a thing, right? Let's say Vanity Fair wants Annie Leibovitz to do a photo shoot for The Sopranos. And they call up Industria Super Studios, they book a studio there, and it is like an all-day affair where they're doing these shoots. And then, like Matt said, there's a setup and there's a breakdown, just like in the world of theater and live music. But this happens on a daily basis at these places. And Industria was, for a time, the premier such studio. Milk also was very, very high up there. I think still is. Both are still functioning. The game has changed a lot, but a lot of Fashion Week events would happen at both locations. Part of the appeal of these studios are the people that work there. And you worked under two incredible people that I think helped shape your work ethic, as well as sort of your work-life balance, ethic, which we're going to get into a little bit as well. But you worked with the great Kimberly Slayton over at Industria, and you worked with the wonderful Bevan Myers over at Milk, two people that I have worked with and hold in the highest of respect, and I definitely learned from them. But I know you worked a lot closer with them, and I think that they were two wonderful people to learn from in that respect. And again, a lot of their work ethic, I think, you know, you saw what to do right and what not to do in certain situations. And I think that shaped you, you know, for your reinvention, when you did eventually take that. And I do want to go back.
Absolutely.
I want to go back a little bit further too, to the Sinead O'Connor thing, because I did kind of want to talk about this, because when this happened, the Saturday Night Live thing happened, we didn't really know as teenagers, right? You know, I was probably in senior year of high school. You were already in college, I think freshman year at that point, or
yep.
like around that cusp, right? And
yep.
we just saw this woman who, you know, was we knew as a singer, tear up an iconic religious figure that, you know, on live television, and we didn't understand the nuance of it at the time. And I don't think a lot of people really did. And, you know, what she was trying to do was to call attention to abuses going on in an institution, and that figurehead was turning a blind eye to. And then another layer of it was apparently she had a very abusive mother, and that was her mother's picture, you know, that her mother cherished that she tore up on live television. So when she hits the stage about 2 weeks later at MSG, no one really knows any of this context, any of this. Everyone knows that she just did something that upset a lot of people and didn't know the meaning behind it. I always think of an equation to when Prince changed his name to the symbol. People just thought it was Prince being Prince. But it was, you know, that was because at that point his name wasn't his own. It was still under trademark and contract with Warner's, and that was a whole contract dispute. So he said, well, if I can't use my own name, I'm going to do this symbol as my name. So there's a lot of nuanced things that we just didn't quite get at the time. And I contribute some of that to age, you know, our age at the time. But I also contribute some of that, I think, to a pre, you know, internet information age, where a lot of these details, now details come too far, too fast, too frequently, too soon, and you kind of really have to disseminate and pour through. But I think back then, yeah, there was just a very surface anger of what she had done, which is why that crowd erupted the way it did at MSG. And again, MSG being pretty much the mothership, the heart of the action, you know, that is now an iconic piece of MSG history. And now with context, we can kind of see what was going on there. So it's like, I don't begrudge anybody for booing her, because that was the emotion at the time. And emotions, especially in a place of entertainment in a concert venue like that, emotion is just like a wave that just ripples through the crowd, right? And so,
sure.
So I find it amazing, though, that you were present for that and you felt that in that venue. This for I think everybody involved, just this horrible experience, but is now something that is, you know, looked at as a piece of history.
Yeah,
and again, that's the only
boo.
Time that you've experienced that.
So you know, I didn't boo. Right on.
Yeah, I think you had mentioned that. Yeah, you were shocked. You were stunned.
I don't even boo at Yankee Stadium. I always say I want to root for my team. I don't root against the other team. I root for my team.
Yeah.
But, you know, really, it's about energy, right?
Yeah.
And when you're in a big room full of people like that, and that energy is contagious, and that energy can sometimes kind of, you know, turn into a mob mentality very quick. As you saw the other day in Union Square, you know,
exactly.
You get enough people together and emotions are running high and
you promise free stuff and don't deliver.
Or you rip up a picture of the Pope.
Yep.
And you get people that start, you know, start bringing all of their energy together. But you know, really that's what you go to concerts for, right? And
exactly,
it's to experience that energy. Really the only type of energy that you know, the only way that you can access that type of energy, you can't buy it on TV, you can't watch it on TV, you can't feel it in your living room. To be in a room with 20,000 other screaming maniacs all kind of concentrating on the same thing and with all their energy, you know, coming at full blast, that's really what, you know, what it's all about. And, you know, for me, it's always, listen, as a pop culture historian yourself, this goes back to human culture, right? Human beings have always had a sense of and a desire for ritual, okay? Going back to cavemen gathering with a drum around a fire, there has always been the human desire for, you know, ritual and coming together as a group, you know, songs and entire cultures are built around, you know, these rituals. Religion stems from all of these rituals. And, you know, it's like it's the difference between going to a church or a temple, mosque, or synagogue and sitting there alone with your thoughts, singularly by yourself, and saying a prayer and being having that room on a Sunday morning filled with people singing and all putting their thoughts and energies behind, you know, a song or a prayer. And number one, it brings people together. Number two, you know, it really kind of channels that energy into, you know, a positive place. So, you know, you can be in a room with 20,000 strangers. And if, you know, a guy like Eric Clapton is standing up there and everyone in that crowd is hanging on every single note he's playing, you know, Jerry Garcia used to say that every note he played had a little personality to it. And he would kind of introduce all of these notes to each other and that each note was like a little spirit. You know, you see guys like Jerry Garcia, Eric Clapton, Jimi Hendrix. These guys are like wizards. You know, they are like modern day wizards. And, you know, if you look at a song like it's a spell, if you look at, you know, a catchy guitar riff that you can't get out of your head, you know, there's something to that. You know, if you believe in music, you have to believe in magic because they both they both walk hand in hand. And I can tell you for sure, you know, I've seen one guy stand up on a stage and control 20,000 people in the palm of their hand. I just saw it last night.
Yes, you did.
So, you know, it's something where, you know, I thrive on that energy. And that was one of the things during the pandemic that was really, I really started missing as time went on, was just the roar of the crowd. You know, being at a baseball game, Aaron Judge hits a home run. Every single fan is jumping up and down. The place is shaking. I mean, that's really what happens. You look at Yankee Stadium, it's like a cathedral. Madison Square Garden, it's like a big church. And when 20,000 people are all jumping up and down at the same time, the building literally shakes. The foundations of the building literally shake. And sometimes, especially at Madison Square Garden, because it's up on the fifth floor, and it is literally on giant shock absorbers above Penn Station.
I have felt that,
You felt it, right? So, you know, if a band is in the middle of a, you know, a crazy jam and the place is really rocking and everybody is jumping up and down and they're all jumping down to the same beat and you stand still, you will feel the entire building shaking. If you're in the hallway and you're walking past one of the bars, take a look at the liquor inside the bottles. It literally splashes. It literally swings. If it didn't, the building would crumble. You know, it has to have bounce to it. It has to have give. So that to me is like the ultimate feeling when you're in the building and it's really rocking and the lights are out, you know, late night arena rock and the energy is flowing. And, you know, that's really the same reason people have been going to church for hundreds of years.
I want to do some numbers here. I want to do a little bit of a number trivia. So we're going to ask you a couple. This is easy math, I think, for you, because I think you keep it running track of these things. So first and foremost, this one I'm guessing you know. So excluding, you know, Bugs Bunny Super Friends at the Felt Forum and WWF events and things like that, sporting events, how many live music concerts have you seen at MSG?
At Madison Square Garden, I've seen 78 Fish concerts.
I was going to get to that. Yeah, in general, how many? If you know the number, how many
78 or 79? I just don't know what. I only missed one over the years.
Yeah, I was going to say. So Fish has done 79 shows at MSG.
Okay, so if they've done 79, then I've done 78, which is more than Elton John, who was second place. Just passed him a couple of days ago. Also, the Grateful Dead had 56 was the record for a while.
Right, but the number of Fish is chasing at MSG is Billy Joel.
Right.
And Billy Joel
He's going to be at 99 at the end of this whole residency.
Right.
Probably do a 100th show, right?
Oh, I'm sure. I don't doubt that you have seen more shows at Madison Square Garden than Billy Joel has played at Madison Square Garden.
Oh, for sure. I'm coming for it.
In general. Oh, yeah, I think you've seen more shows at Madison Square Garden than Billy Joel. So now we're going to talk a little
totally
bit about
possible.
Fish. And we're going to talk about Fish. Before we kind of fill people who might not know in on what this band is, how many Fish shows have you seen?
231 or 232.
Amazing.
Yeah, closing in on 250. The guy who was sitting next to me at Madison Square Garden, they were just there for 7 nights, and you could get a 7-night ticket, so you're in the same seat for all 7 nights.
Yeah.
Therefore, you're sitting with the same people surrounding you. So by the end of the 7 nights, everybody's friends, and you've kind of formed some relationships. And on the first night, the guy who was sitting next to me was wearing a pin that it was his 250th show.
Nice.
So he had a really really great experience. But just like the Grateful Dead or a lot of the old jazz pioneers, Fish never plays the same show twice. They never play a song the same way twice, and they're very creative with the songs that they play. They've also got such a deep catalog of music. You could be seeing them for 30 years and still have not seen them perform a certain song. Sometimes
and
you have to be at the right place
on,
at the right time.
Yeah. Adding on to their original compositions, they also have a huge catalog of covers. So really quick, so for people who don't know, I know we've talked on a previous show, another friend of the show, Douglas Cuenca, also aficionado, we talked a little bit about the band. And so for those who don't know, Fish was a band that's a bunch of kids from New Jersey who are really just music nerds, all wound up meeting in and around the Burlington, Vermont area. And in the early 80s, formed a band, and it is one of those rare bands that since its inception, and we're going to sort of, they did have a fifth member, but we're going to he left early enough that you could say that one of the few bands that has been performing as long as they have and as consistently as they have with the same four members of the band. There has never been guy going, oh, I'm done, and new drummer comes in, or things like that. They have all done various solo projects, but they have managed to be this unit for over 40 years now. And like Matt said, one of the hallmarks of the experience is, you get a two-set show with an encore. You get a different show, a different set list every night. Songs are opened up, extrapolated, and interpreted in various ways. So, yeah, there's really, you know, certain, there's a lot of songs where they're never played the same way twice, especially when they find these pockets to explore in a song. And that can change over years, too. There could be a song that for, you know, 15 years, they're always opening up this one pocket, right? They're always opening up, exploring musically this one little section of the song, this, you know. But then 5 years later, they're going to find a different pocket, right, and open up and explore that. Sometimes songs will go unfinished because of this, but it is very cool because a lot of their more intricate works have sort of a classical music composition. Songs like You Enjoy Myself, which are largely instrumental and with different movements and different pieces and different segments that go into them. And I've seen this carry through now to a lot of the post-rock bands. You have a lot of instrumental rock bands right now that construct songs very much the same way that Phish does, even though they'll never necessarily cop to listening to the band. They're aware, right? Another thing that Phish is known for are their musical Halloween costumes, where they will, you know, it used to be where they would do a Halloween show. It would be a three-set show. In the middle set, they would cover another band's album in its entirety. The Beatles' White Album, The Who, Quadrophenia, Talking Heads' Remain in Light. These are now all part of the Phish repertoire, and songs have from those albums have hit into the rotation as well. And that's the thing. A lot of people kind of say, oh, it's just a Grateful Dead, you know, style band. And it's really not, because Grateful Dead was more the traditional and jazz age sort of roots, you know, real folk blues roots. Now, Phish does delve into the blues, there's no doubt. But I definitely see bands like Talking Head being a huge influence on Phish. The Beatles, later works, being a huge influence on Phish. And bands like Pavement that are definitely inform what they do. And even a lot of the punk bands and some of the ska bands. And, you know, this is the thing, is that, like I said, these guys are four music nerds who just love the whole of music, and that they will even find a contemporary pop song that will make it into the rotation, just even if it's for a laugh. It's there. They are aware. They do it because I think these guys pay attention to everything. And so the appeal, you know, because some people will be like, 250 of this band. Like, you don't understand. Like, it is an amazing, energy-filled experience. It is a shared but unique communal experience for each individual that is there. And if you just let yourself go and just surrender to the energy, you will get it and you will feel it. Even if you're like, I don't like this music, you just look around and you just see all these people having fun. There's nothing like it in the world. And I think that you could absolutely attest to and agree to that.
Well, it's like why people have season tickets for a football team or for a baseball team.
Yep.
You know, you never go to a baseball game and see the exact same game twice. That's one of the amazing things about baseball, is that the game has been around for 150 years, and still today things are happening that have never happened before. Same thing with Phish. You know, they've been around for 40 years, obviously not as long as baseball, but they've got such a long history and such a deep catalog of things that they've been playing for 40 years. You know, they've played on a little bit more than 1,000 different songs. So you can, you know, dip back into, you know, something that they played 20 years ago and play it new today, like it's fresh and with a different take on it. You know, an interesting stat, since we're talking about numbers, the song Cracklin' Rosie by Neil Diamond, song that Phish has played a couple of times over the years, and not a lot. Now, I've been seeing them for 30 years, okay? The other night, they played Cracklin' Rosie. The last time I had seen them perform that song was in 1996, okay? So it had been 198 shows in between those two performances that I saw. Now, you can only really do that if you last for four, if you're a band that lasts for 40 years, you know, you can only really rack up those stats. You know, a guy like Cal Ripken Jr. in baseball has stats like no other player has because he lasted so long and he played in so many games. You know, so if you have staying power and you just, you know, keep going one game at a time or one concert at a time, over time, all of those numbers start to add up. So, you know, interesting thing that you mentioned about Phish is, you know, again, the wide history. Now, I mentioned Cracklin' Rosie earlier. There was a song that they played on Friday night, which is a song that they've been playing since 1985. And over the years, they've improvised a million different ways on this song. And it's a really good song. It's a, you know, a song called Mike's Song. Now, the bass player of the band is Mike, and this is his song. Really good song. And usually a big crowd favorite. And the other night, they played the longest version of it that they had ever played, which was a little bit over 23 minutes. And it was 23 minutes that explored every different style of music. So, you know, you talk about their set lists, and they're a band that'll play, you know, a jazz song next to a bluegrass song, next to a metal song, next to a Rolling Stones cover, and then go into a Beatles cover after that. And their set lists are comprised of all these different styles and types of music. Like you said earlier, they're music nerds, but they're also kind of like, you know, they just swallow up all these different sounds. Every album that they've covered over the years has formed and, you know, helped evolve their sound from clubs to theaters to arenas. They don't really play too many stadiums, but you know, over the years, all the different styles and types of music that they play have become a part of their overall style. And so during that song the other night, that was 23 minutes, during the course of that song, they went through different styles of music. And, you know, when you have a 23-minute jam, you know, it's not jung, jugga, jung, jugga, jung over and over again. You know, they have to make it interesting. They have to make it creative. And that's something that they've gotten better and better and better at doing over the years. And adding different instruments, different types of effects into it. So, you know, you'll hear a guitar riff that they've been playing for 30 years, but they play it a little bit differently with, you know, a little bit of a different sound effect on it. And, you know, that's how they kind of, you know, keep the variety going. You know, variety is the spice of life, right?
Yep. And it's funny that, like you mentioned Mike's Song, the evolution of how that song was always presented in shows has evolved as well. Because early on, it was like a triptych, right? It was a Mike's Song,
it was a suite,
little
yes.
instrumental interlude, Hydrogen, and then Weekapaw Groove, right? And then there was a point where they got known for playing, they would jump on two of the bassist Mike Gordon and the lead guitarist, lead vocalist Trey Anastasio would bounce on trampolines during Mike's Song. And then that, you know, then they started playing with the middle piece and they would do different stuff. They would throw Cities in there, you know, you know, which was a Talking Heads cover or, you know, and they would kind of play around with that structure in that format. And then again, with the introduction of special you know, sound effects and things like that, like, you know, pedals and rigs and things like that, you know, people get so, even the most devoted, they get so used to a certain expectation, right? So when it stopped becoming a consistent Mike's Hydrogen Weekapod and started being different things, you know, a lot of people were like, whoa, what's going on here? I don't know if I like this. And then it's like, oh, okay, now here's something else that is going to be a nice surprise and that you didn't necessarily expect happen, which makes even the familiar exciting and new, you know? And I think that that's a great testament. And again, they're sort of jazz mentality on opening up these songs and playing these songs and keeping it interesting, obviously for them, but also for the fans. And that's a tough trick, right? To make everybody happy. But they really do seem to do that really well, because as anyone I think who has ever been disgruntled with, oh, Fish did this, and da-da-da. They still come back. They're still going. And they're like, wow, now they're better than they have been, you know? So there's definitely something about how in tune they are to what's happening in front of them as well, and how they feed off that energy and that you know, excitement from the crowd. And it really just becomes this sort of conversation between the band and the audience. And I know I've felt that. I felt moments where it's like, ah, these guys, that's how I'm feeling right now in this moment. And they keyed in on that. And that's just really cool. There's a great interview with Trey that I remember we found and always referred to in college, where he talks about Carlos Santana explaining the hose theory, H-O-Z-E, right? Or H-O-S-E, the hose. Like, you're playing your guitar, and it's like you're a gardener with a hose, and you're spraying your water out on the audience, and the audience is like the grass growing. And when you're in, like, I'm really paraphrasing it badly, but it's like when you're locked in on that feeling, when you have that communication between artist and audience, it's like you're shooting the hose out onto the crowd. I always thought that was a cool thing.
Well, that was one of the things that always drew me to the band. And like I was saying earlier, you know, it's not just with Fish, but, you know, I really noticed it with Eric Clapton, how he can just really hold the crowd in the palm of his hands. You know, Paul McCartney, these guys that have been entertaining for 40, 50, 60 years, 75 years, that know how to read a room and know how to get the crowd up on their feet, because it's their job. They've been doing it day in and day out. You know, it's amazing. Sometimes, you know, you get up to work in the morning, you're like, I don't feel so good today. I'm a little bit tired. My back hurts. But, you know, these guys get out there every night and they play a show like they're in their 20s. And, you know, you had mentioned earlier about the fact that it's the same four members of the band. And I think there's really a lot to that because, you know, they almost have kind of a telepathy with each other where they know where they're going to go. They can read each other's minds and they can form each individual like Voltron, right? They can each have their own, you know, power and their own energy, but then there's the combination, the sum of all the parts, you know? So each individual band member will be playing their own, you know, separate masterpiece, but then when they all are being played together and you add that to the lighting guy who's been their lighting guy for 35 years, and not for nothing, it's the same people in the crowd, too. You know? Like, I've been seeing them
people
for 30
have grown
years.
Up with this band. We've all been
there together through the, you know, New Year's concerts and Halloween concerts. And so the crowd even knows to anticipate. And the crowd can even kind of have the same kind of telepathy with the band. And then when it's all firing on all cylinders, that's really when you kind of get to that moment where Madison Square Garden is shaking.
Yeah. And not to mention the sense of fun that they try to exude on the crowd. You know, a lot of the their big event shows, like their New Year's and their Halloween's these past few years, you know, because they're a bigger band, they're bigger production numbers, right? But they always love to kind of wow the crowd. And, you know, and even as far back as, you know, a New Year's show where they rode over Boston Garden, the audience in a giant hot dog, you know, just things like that get people excited and get people talking. And then even before that, they used to do the secret language stuff where they knew that people were starting to see them consistently and really paying attention and picking up on what's going on, that they would do these little, you know, musical notes, these musical quotes, right, that would prompt the people who knew in the audience to respond accordingly. My favorite is, because there's actually, and there's a great thing about the culture, too, is, you know, back when we were in college, these are things called cassette tapes. We'd go to a place called Prime Cuts, and you'd buy a blank cassette tape that they would record a live Fish show on it for you. You would pick out of a book what show you wanted. You're only paying for the tape, right? The bootleg tape phenomenon that was heavy with the Grateful Dead really kicked into gear with Fish. And then in the digital age, Fish has actually started to release a lot of these shows, and so all of this is out there now for people to listen to.
Well,
and one of my
really
favorites
important
is when,
element, the really important element of it too was we wouldn't just buy them, but we would trade them. And
we
that's
trade
where
them like baseball
kind of,
cards.
Yep, we would trade them like baseball cards. And that's where the sense of community comes in.
Yep. And so just really, but the secret language, like one of my favorite ones is that when he explains, when he does turn, right? The notes from that song to everything, turn, he would play that. And then the people who know would turn around and just scream at the person standing in front of them. And he says, all for the effect for the people that don't know what's going on, just to kind of wake them up a little bit, just to kind of freak them out a little bit. And I just think that that's the greatest thing, just having
well,
fun
really
with
was,
your audience.
It really was like the first viral marketing, right? Because they knew that their entire community of, you know, they weren't just, you know, we weren't just fans. We were also collectors, right? Collectors of their concerts. Every concert was different. But they knew that we were going to get the concert that happened tonight, you know, within the next 2 weeks, we'd trade it with somebody. They had tapers in the crowd every night who were hanging on their every word. So they knew all they had to do is let the crowd in at one small show, you know, down south somewhere, and that by the next year when they came back to that city, people would have been trading that tape all year long, and they would know exactly what the language was. So if you were a new fan, you would walk in off the street, and you would hear, you know, them do one of the secret language signals, and it just, you know, signaled the crowd. And you know, could you imagine walking into a concert and hearing the Simpsons theme and the whole crowd goes, "Don't!" at the
Don't!
Same time?
Yeah, makes,
or
yeah,
like you had
great.
Mentioned earlier, the birds turn, and the whole crowd stands and turns and looks at the back of the theater. Well, this was the stuff that they were doing, you know, 25, 30 years ago that was creative, that no other bands were doing. And all it took was a little bit of viral marketing. Before the internet, it was tape trading, but then
tape
they were
trading,
also one of the first bands that really kind of knew the power of the internet and chat rooms, and they used that to also, you know, virally market their concerts and, you know, to start rumors and, you know, to really kind of, you know, get the fan base interested and engaged. And really what it does, and it's translates to when you're in the room and there's 20,000 people there and the band is rocking, it's synergy, right? Between the crowd and the band, between, you know, it's everybody that's in the building. You know, sometimes I talk to, you know, the hot dog vendors. How do you like the show tonight? Oh, yeah, last night was better than tonight. You know, like sometimes, you know, they're enjoying the show for the first time. They've never heard the band before. And they listen to a completely different style of music.
I've seen security people just gigging, rocking out, and be like, this is great. This is better than we had last night, you know?
Cops, uniformed police officers I've seen dancing at shows.
Yeah, it's infectious. It is very much infectious in a good way. So, Matt, we have a little bit over 5 minutes left. So a couple things I do want to touch on. Now you have met all four members of the band at various times, just like
sure,
I have.
Sure.
Now, I had it easy because I was living in Burlington, Vermont, so it was very easy to cut across paths with these guys, especially when I was working at a nightclub, you know, as well. But you also met at least one Beatle?
Yes. Sorry, my voice is a little hoarse from screaming and yelling at rock concerts the last week. One of the greatest gifts, one of the greatest joys and blessings of my life was being able to work with Paul McCartney on and off a little bit over the course of a year. And it was right after 9/11 was an interesting experience that I had, and really nice guy. And, got to, you know, see him on a daily basis for a while, and you know, we became very friendly, and you know, every once in a while we talk about music, talk about Jimi Hendrix. I never talked to him about the Beatles. That was one thing I never, but you know, really he was just a nice guy, and he appreciated, you know, it's like if you've ever met someone who's like enlightened, you know, who's like an enlightened Buddhist, or, you know, someone who's like, who you can tell has been studying spirituality for a really long time. They, you know, kind of have this sense of peace about them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was something that, you know, I really, the other thing about him too was, you know, he was a Beatle his whole life. So he appreciated a guy who would just talk to him about, you know, the weather and,
well, yep.
you know, normal stuff.
And now you had a really, I will always remember this, and I've actually used this, you know, in anecdotes for folks, and it's always a tribute to you, but you had a really funny exchange where you introduced himself, you introduced yourself to him. And
yeah,
you remember this, right? You want to,
oh, yeah.
You should say this, because I love this.
Well, no, I mean, I almost lost my job. You know,
oh, really?
Those, yeah, oh, yeah, this was like the first day that he was at the studio. Now, the reason why he was there every day was because he was engaged to Heather Mills, who
yep.
was the Federated Department Store cover model. And she was doing a campaign. She was shooting several catalogs over the course of, you know, probably a 8-month period, 8 to 10 months. And he would come in the morning. He would carry her bags, perfect gentleman. He would send her flowers. Over time, he sent her flowers, but he would send them to me at the desk because, you know, he didn't want to sign his name to them. He knew I knew where to bring them. You know, the first day that he came in, I was gobsmacked. I didn't expect Paul McCartney was going to walk in that day. I had Federated Department Stores. I had a catalog shoot going on. And
yep.
So I figured, oh, this is my one and only chance to shake his hand and tell him, you know, tell him he's awesome. Tell him he wrote the soundtrack to my life, which I'm sure he's heard a million times before over the years. And, you know, I did. And I approached him. And shook his hand, and the general manager of the studio at the time came running out of the office. It was probably, looking at it from their perspective, it was probably a horror show unfolding right in front of their eyes. And, you know, I got a real severe talking to, and really almost lost my job. Really almost.
Oh, wow.
Almost ended it.
That part I didn't know. It was the name thing that I was...
See, here's the thing, though. It worked to my advantage with Paul McCartney because he saw that I was, like, willing to put shit out on the line just to shake his hand.
Yeah.
And so after that, he was like, oh, you know, this, I earned his respect that day. And, you know, towards the end of his tenure there, you know, like I said, he and I were very friendly. And that same general manager was, you know, sitting with me. And Paul came in and we were chatting for a little bit, went upstairs and, you know, they turned to me and they said, you're friends with Paul McCartney. Yeah, I guess a little bit. And then I don't think I ever saw him again after that.
Right.
And he doesn't send me any Christmas cards either.
He doesn't send you doesn't write you any silly love songs.
No.
But I remember you saying you introduced yourself to him, or you said, oh, it's nice to meet you. And he goes, oh, it's nice to meet you, mate. And you get, oh no, it's Matt. I love that. I always love that. That is you, quick on your feet.
Yeah.
Always want to bring a smile to somebody's face. So, Matt, we just have basically have under 2 minutes left. So, any parting words before we go on how to maximize the work-life balance? I wanted to get into that a little bit more. Maybe we'll save that for the next time you're on the Pep Talk, because I'm definitely having you back. But really quick, in like 1 minute. What do you got to say to the folks about finding that perfect work-life balance?
Well, you know, first of all, it's about finding a life balance. We all have to work. You know, we all have to, you know, take care of our responsibilities. But, you know, there are certain things, you know, I've been seeing fish for 30 years, and I've had four different careers during that time. So there are certain things, you know, going to baseball games, the things that bring you joy, those are really the things that are the priorities in life. Work
yeah.
just fills in the days in between. And, you know, we all go through our struggles. We all have our challenges. We all deal with, you know, heartache and tragedy. The trick is to fill the days in between those bad milestones with good ones. and you know, to pursue the things that make you happy, pursue the things that bring you joy, whether it's sports or music or going to concerts. You know, you have to have those outlets in life. You have to be able to blow off some steam, and you have to have the things in life that keep you happy.
We're out of time, gentlemen. I'm sorry, but we're out of time.
No worries, no worries. Well, Matt, very well said. Thank you very much. We're definitely going to have you back.
Pleasure.
Folks, thanks for checking out the Pep Talk.
Good night, everybody. Thanks.
Good night.